Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 24th of August. Mondays at 9, all things political. Our guest this hour is Professor Daryl Paul, Associate Professor of Political Science at Williams College, teaches courses on world politics and the global political economy, global political ecology, the politics of the international economy, and imperialism. We have a lot to talk about today. We'll look at the U.S. economy, the world economy, healthcare, of course, what people are thinking about the president's performance, what people are thinking about the Republican performance. An interesting article over the weekend on Afghanistan asking the question, will the presidency ultimately be defined in the rugged terrain of Afghanistan? So those are a few of the areas that we'll be exploring this hour and welcoming your contributions. Of course, our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address, feel free to use that, is talk@wpr.org. Professor Daryl Paul, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Yeah. Could we start with the world economy? We heard little indications over the past couple weeks that some countries like Germany may be doing a little bit better when it comes to the world recession. What's your sense of what's going on in the world when it comes to the economy?
It's a great question. I think there's so many different things going on. It's hard to put together a comprehensive story, but it does look like things are beginning to turn around in some of the countries in Western Europe. It's probably too early to make a sort of a conclusive decision about what's going on in Europe overall. Britain was kind of in the same mess that the U.S. has been in terms of big real estate bubble, big deficits in terms of sort of personal household income things. Eastern Europe's got its own problems, but Europe seems to be doing okay. Eastern Asia seems to be kind of a mixed bag as well. China seems to be doing all right, although lots of people suspect it's because of this huge infusion of money into their economy that the government's going to have to pull sooner or later. The collapse of trade has just been enormous, and that's affected East Asia quite a lot. So if trade comes back, East Asia probably will do all right. The U.S., surprisingly, perhaps for many, seems to be doing the worst of the major countries.
And why do you think that's true?
Well, I suspect it's because the Great Recession, if we can call it that, began here. And so many of the problems that spread globally had their origins here. Lots of U.S. debt, lots of houses and securities based on houses in the U.S. that were sold to banks worldwide. The auto industry really had its biggest collapse here in the U.S. And so I think because it all began here, that it'll probably be the most difficult for the U.S. to get out of it.
Is this part of the problem? Bob Herbert had an interesting column on Saturday suggesting that people who are worried about holding on to their standard of living need to be assured that a new program, a new healthcare program that will be expensive, is in their best interest.
I think that's right. I think a lot of what the Republicans have been able to tap into is some legitimate fears and concerns that a lot of public policy is designed to help certain very well-connected people and interests, not least of which is Wall Street. And lots of the rest of the country has been forgotten, or at least it's sort of a trickle-down idea that if we help certain people, then that will somehow diffuse out to the rest of society. I think lots of people just don't believe it. They're concerned, and I think rightly so.
Mm-hmm. The president said some months ago when he first started in office, he was asked the question repeatedly, what signs do you need to see in order to have a sense that the economy is doing better? And he talked about the number of jobs that needed to be saved or the number of jobs that needed to be that would be gained. Where is he on track with those figures that he announced or way off?
In terms of the jobs numbers, I guess the best way to measure it might be the stress test that the federal government put the banks on a few months back. And in terms of the most kind of egregious numbers that they thought were possible in terms of jobs versus the kind of baseline that they forecast, the job losses have been in between those two. It's been worse than the baseline. It's been closer to the more severe outcome. But if we look at other kinds of things, in terms of housing prices, that's basically following the baseline scenario. So it depends on what kinds of measures we use. For jobs seems to be the worst part of the kind of economic profile of the country right now. And what's been going on in jobs in the United States has been far worse in a relative sense, relative to where we were, say, a year ago, than what happened back certainly in the early 1990s under President Clinton or in the early 2000s under President Bush, even far worse than the recession of the early 1980s under President Reagan.
What's happened with all the stimulus money, Professor Paul? Do you know?
I don't know that I got very much of mine. At least I didn't get my bank bailout money. In terms of the stimulus, I guess some of it is visible. I can say that in my part of the country, which is Western Massachusetts, we had a road that was paved with stimulus money. And I know that because the government put up a big sign right on the road to tell us all. So I got a nicely paved road out of the stimulus money. Certainly there's the Cash for Clunkers program. There have been various kinds of construction projects, I think, that were designed to try to get that money in relatively quickly. And so certainly the stimulus has done some things. I think the question is whether it's really going to stimulate the economy, that is, it's going to jumpstart things, or whether this is just going to tie us over, and therefore maybe in a few months, maybe in the fall, as early as the fall, perhaps we'll be talking about a second stimulus. Some economists, I think Paul Krugman is the most prominent one, or have been talking about a second stimulus for a while now.
Mm-hmm. There had been reports a while ago that banks were holding back quite a bit of that money. Have they released more of it for the stimulus?
In terms of the banks, the bank money is, in some sense, the bailout money, not so much the stimulus program, but the TARP money that was passed when President Bush was still in office. And if you look at the data that comes from the Federal Reserve, it's very nice data, and you can see how much money that the banks are accumulating in terms of their reserves, that is money that they have in their possession, but they're not releasing out to the wider economy. And those numbers are still extremely high, extremely elevated. So even though the Federal Reserve has kind of massively increased its balance sheet, and which leads some people to be very concerned about inflation in the future, none of that money, or at least very little of it, is getting out into the wider public.
You mentioned the Cash for Clunkers program. Wildly successful or problematic in some ways?
Well, depends, I suppose, on what our measures are. Wildly successful, certainly in terms of public response. Just the fact that the Congress had to go back and add another $2 billion to it after the first billion was spent in about a week suggests that it kind of exceeded wildly its expectations. But again, I think the question is this something that's going to be very temporary in terms of an economic jolt, or is this really going to stimulate? Is this really going to prime the pump, if you will, and then the economy can begin working and growing on its own? It seems like it's probably much more of the former. That is, it's going to give a jolt for now, which is worth something, certainly, especially to people who are in those auto sectors and regions where the auto sector is very important. But in a longer-term sense, personally, I'm skeptical. I don't know that it's going to really jumpstart the economy. And so I think the state, the government, that is going to still have an important role to play in trying to generate economic demand.
Mm. Is it coupled at all with people who did the right thing in the first place and thought that they would buy cars that were more fuel efficient because it was good for the environment, et cetera? Are they getting a deal?
Well, I think so. Some of the arguments against the Cash for Clunkers program was that it's really just stealing demand in the future and bringing it to today. Mm-hmm. And so that essentially, right, it's people who are going to buy cars anyway. Instead of buying them in a year, they're going to buy them today. The funny thing about the program in terms of the environmental aspects is that you didn't have to buy a car that was terribly fuel efficient. I mean, I guess it was nice to get those kind of 15-mile-a-gallon cars off the road, but it's not like it was meant to be a green program. It was primarily meant to be a program for the auto sector and for general consumption. I think the environmental dimensions were secondary.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about health care. Every time I mention it, the phone lines are just flooded because everybody wants to talk about it. Let's look at this in terms of the Republicans. Do you think that Republicans, whose poll numbers are way down there, the president is slipping, but the Republicans are way down there, need to offer some kind of fairly thorough health care plan of their own?
Need to, I suppose, in a political sense, I think they don't. They may be learning a lesson that the Democrats learned when President Bush was in office and the Republicans had the Congress. Because when the president wanted to radically overhaul Social Security and privatize a dimension of it, the Democrats became very disciplined and they said, we're not going to offer an alternative plan. We're just simply going to say, no, what we have now is fine. If you want to hear what our real alternative is, vote for us. Put us in office and then we'll do it. And I think because of the party discipline, that was a real, politically, a winning strategy for the Democrats. And so perhaps the Republicans are doing something similar. They're not in power. There's very little they can do to make their vision a reality, at least in the short term. So it is, you know, perhaps looking forward more to 2010 and saying to the public, if you don't like what the Democrats have to offer, vote for us. And then you'll see what we have.
Mm-hmm. And what about the president, who's been criticized by progressives in this country for not coming up with a plan, with a health care plan that is fully fleshed out, that we don't know exactly what it is he wants?
I think the president certainly has learned at least the lesson, or at least what he perceived to be the lesson, from the problem that President Clinton had back in the early 90s, which was bring a very fleshed out, very detailed, very wonky proposal to the Congress, allow very little in terms of changes, and make them vote on it. I think Obama decided that that was really a bad strategy. So lay out some general principles, stick to those big talking points, and let the Congress craft the particulars. I think what's been really unfortunate, or at least certainly for Obama, is that he had intended this to really get out of the committees before the Congress went home. So the problem, or one of the big problems, I think, is that when Congress members go back to their districts in August and start talking to their constituents, they can't really say a lot of specifics about the bills because there are a whole bunch of bills and they're going to have to be reconciled at some point. And so you get the kinds of things that happened in Pennsylvania when Senator Arlen Specter kept saying, well, you know, the bill's not written yet. The bill's not written yet. It's true. The bills aren't written yet, but that's not very comforting to people who really want to know what's coming down the pike.
Right. And need to know so they can drown out all the angry voices.
Yeah, I mean the Senate has a bill. I think the House has three different bills, and so it's difficult to say anything definitive. And so if this would have gotten hammered out before the Congress went home, which I think is what the president had hoped for, I think the kinds of discussions going on this month would have been a lot more productive and certainly probably would have gone a lot better politically for the Democrats than they have.
All Things Political is what you're listening to this hour, and we have phone calls. We have one line open, 800-486-8655 is our number. Mike from Appleton, our first caller. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Three very quick comments. First, the question here with Lockerbie, I think that's absolutely disgusting, and I'm amazed that we haven't taken a much stronger position. One. Two, I'd like your guest comment on the fact that on Friday, the Obama administration released new numbers as far as a 10-year deficit and tacked on, what was it, $2.3 trillion extra? And that was simply because, you know, their projections for the future were based upon a 4% growth rate, which is ridiculous. And, you know, so there we are.
Certainly I can speak to the second part, the 10-year deficit. What the Obama administration essentially did was recognize that the numbers that the Congressional Budget Office had put out earlier this year were, in fact, a lot more accurate than the ones that they had come up with. So the president's administration was saying, exactly as your caller said, $7.1 trillion a deficit, and the CBO was saying $9 trillion, and as it turns out, the CBO number was a lot more accurate, and so the Obama administration is essentially kind of confessing to a much more realistic picture.
And thanks for your call. Scott from Green Bay, hi.
Good morning. I'm wondering if some of the countries have come out of this recession a little bit faster than us because of some of the actions they've taken. I mean, you look at China with the amount of money they've infused in their economy, which was directly stimulative. And yet we're talking about a second stimulus package when 85% of what we've committed, $750 billion, has not been spent. And if you take a look at it, which I have, if you take a look at where the money is going, there are so much of it that is headed towards things that are not stimulative. I mean, we need to stimulate our economy. Healthcare is a perfect example of this. We should be worried about health care. We should take care of health care when we have stimulated economy. We can't commit another $1 trillion when we're going bankrupt. I mean, we just fix all the bridges and roads. I mean, do everything for the infrastructure that's going to create jobs. But if you read that recovery package, so much of it is not stimulative at all. It's just a waste of money.
Professor Paul?
I think the real problem with this recession and the attitude in terms of the administration and the Congress of wanting to, right, quote, stimulate, unquote, the economy, is that so much of our economy in the United States today is driven by final consumption. It's far higher than any economy in the world. We rely on households to buy stuff. And because households have built up such a tremendous amount of debt, what so many people are now worried about is trying to get out from under that debt burden. They're not interested in borrowing money to buy all kinds of consumer goods, but they just want to get out of debt. They want to restore some balance to their household finances. That's an amazingly difficult situation to stimulate. And so certainly a lot of the things that were passed in the stimulus bill, you know, kind of pork barrel things. It's unfortunately just what is going to happen in a political system like ours, where you have the Congress and it responds to interests in its own districts, et cetera, et cetera. But also I think the Congress is faced with a very different kind of economy. This kind of recession, the one we're in now, is not the same as we had in the early 2000s or the early 1990s or even back to the very severe one of the early 1980s. That this one, because it's caused so much by debt, it's going to be much more difficult to get out of. And this probably has some explanation in terms of why countries in Western Europe seem to be emerging from it faster than we are here in the U.S.
All Things Political, our guest is Professor Daryl Paul, Associate Professor of Political Science at Williams College in Williamston, Massachusetts. And we're talking about all kinds of things, the economy, the U.S. economy, the world economy, the president's poll numbers, the Republicans' poll numbers, the health care debate. We'll talk a little bit about Afghanistan as we carry on. How do we get jobs for people, the Cash for Clunkers program, and more. We have lines open if you'd like to join us. The number, again, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Care to send us an email? That is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Monday. Did you see this piece in the New York Times on August 16th? Spendthrifts and tightwads tend to marry the other. Unfortunately, these dichotomized duos report unhappier marriages than people with more similar attitudes toward spending. We'll look at this report from the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Michigan, and Northwestern University. And it looked at a married couple and ask them to assess separately their personal feelings toward spending money. Connie Kilmark will be joining us the second hour to talk about this report. All right, back to phone calls for All Things Political. Anne from Madison is next. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Well, first, I think that the United States should stop trying to tell Scotland what their court system should be doing. It sounds as if some people want this guy who has said he was innocent and was convicted on circumstantial evidence to hang by his wrists as he slowly dies of cancer. I just think we ought to shut up in this case. You know, the right-wing media are stirring everybody up. And second, what concerns me a lot, and we hear about it usually on the weekends, is that, of course, the regulators, especially the financial ones, are in almost every case in the Bush administration and in the Obama administration, foxes guarding chicken coops. And what's been happening recently is that, you know, under the so-called stress test, I don't think anybody knows what the stress conditions are. I believe Ben Bernanke is putting them together, maybe with the Treasury Secretary. Great big banks are being infused with no strings attached, huge amounts of money, and smaller banks, one just closed over the weekend, I think it was the Guarantee Trust Company of Texas or something, maybe, you know, some southern states, are being closed and their assets are being transferred, you know, whole hog to these great big banks, and the antitrust regulations are just being totally ignored, so that these institutions really not only are too big to fail, you know, for the benefit of the country, but nobody has the guts or the money to fight them. I think it's a, you know, we're in a really serious crisis here, and there's no transparency at all.
Professor Paul.
I think Anne's got a really great point. This is an issue that is not getting a whole lot of press, and I think over time, at least should be. I hope it does. The banking sector is in real crisis. We've had, I think, about 80 or so banks, some relatively small, some not so small, some, you know, sort of the 10th, 15th largest in the country, this level, banks that have gone bankrupt so far this year. Some are forecasting that number can go as high as 300, maybe even higher. The small banks are the ones who seem to be forced to kind of meet the implications of their bad decisions, whereas the big banks, the J.P. Morgans of the world, the Bank of Americas of the world and whatnot, are the ones that are, quote, too big to fail. And so they are the ones that have the special access to the kinds of funding mechanisms that the Treasury and particularly the Federal Reserve have created. And so we are creating bigger banks. And many have said that the problem from the very beginning was that we have too many large financial institutions and that they should be broken up. We should have smaller banks in this country, at least at the top of the pyramid. And what we seem to be doing is, in fact, the exact opposite.
Thanks, Anne. Wanda is next from Middleton. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. Thank you so much. Your guest had said about the recession wasn't so bad in Europe. I think somebody should be talking about the fact that they have total health care in Europe, and they also have much more of a support system for people who have lost their jobs. So you've got health care facilities that are still supporting people, and you've got people who have support, so even if they lose their job, they have something so they can still buy things. And here in this country, 70% of the people, of the women, don't have health care and family-supporting jobs. Women with family-supporting jobs are the ones that are the most losing their jobs right now. So this is especially bad.
70% of working women don't have health care? Is that what you're saying?
70%. I'm not sure of this, but I did hear the number. 70% of working women do not, or maybe just women in general, do not have health care.
Hmm. I'm certainly not an expert in health care issues. That number sounds far too high to me. But I think the caller has a good point in looking at or being concerned about the status of jobs and its connection to health care. In the United States, the vast majority of people, at least the vast majority of people under 65, have their health insurance attached directly to their employment status, whereas in Europe, it's usually attached to their citizenship status. And particularly in a time like today, when the United States is having tremendous problems with generating jobs. In fact, the Europeans are doing better than the United States at producing jobs, and that's been the case not just in this recession, but over the last 10 to 15 years or so. There is this impression, I think, among many that the United States grows and generates, produces jobs, and the Europeans are stuck in this sort of Eurosclerosis. That was a good story for the 1980s, but it really hasn't been a very accurate story more recently. And so the Obama administration has decided, I think strategically, that they don't want to fundamentally attack that relationship between jobs and employment. That's just so ingrained, it's so embedded in the U.S. healthcare system that I suspect he felt that that was hopeless to take on. So no one's really talking about single payer, for example. But what Obama wants to do is to work with the system that we have, build on top of it, and achieve some kind of universality.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there will be some kind of public option health care plan, or is it going to be cooperatives? What do you imagine?
Personally, I have a feeling that he's going to abandon it.
Really?
And not really because of Republican opposition, because I think at the end of the day, there are so few Republicans that are willing to go along with the Obama administration, the Democrats in the Congress, that just for political reasons, there's really no reason, there's nothing to gain for the Democrats in trying to meet the Republicans on some middle ground. But there are conservative Democrats who are likely to vote against the program, vote against whatever kinds of bills eventually come out of the committees if there is a public option. It's not a for sure thing, but they seem to have some very negative statements to say about this. And so in order to get things like universality, in order to get things like elimination of these pre-existing conditions clauses, and to try to address something in terms of the skyrocketing costs of health care in the United States, I think he's going to have to abandon something, and that seems to be the thing that is least popular widely, not just in the country, but even in his own party.
Mm-hmm. Is it really a cornerstone of health care reform, though, or not?
Well, certainly it's a cornerstone of reform that is going to be what I would call significant. If there is no public option, the kinds of reforms that are likely to pass, and I think something will pass, probably will be along, in terms of the magnitude, something similar to what the Republicans and President Bush passed back in the early part of this decade in terms of adding on the prescription drug coverage to Medicare. And so it won't be a wholesale overhaul. It won't be sort of Lyndon Johnson-size reform. It'll be much more limited.
Mm-hmm. What about it's sort of hard to make sense of all of this in some ways, because it does appear to me that this president was elected to bring in substantial reform in this country, and that if you look at the polls, and even polls late last week, were showing that a good majority of the American public is interested in some kind of public option. And I am having a hard time putting together where we have been on this issue, where we seem to be now, and where Congress is.
It strikes me that the president is cautious. I think he sees the kind of political opposition a lot better than a lot of, say, the early and very enthusiastic supporters of the president during the election campaign back in 2008. So I think he's concerned about Republicans. He's concerned about more moderate Democrats. He's concerned about the insurance industry. He's concerned about the pharmaceutical industry. He's concerned about AARP and the kinds of organizations that are pressing the interests of retired people, people on Medicare. And so even when people say they would like to see reform, I think almost everybody agrees that the healthcare system is not working terribly well. But once we get past that easy agreement, how exactly to fix it, there's just very little agreement on that. And I don't think that the president campaigned strongly on healthcare. And so to take this really big issue on without having, I think, really established this as the most important issue, the one that he's going to tackle, I think we're seeing some of the political fruits of that, that a lot of the people that some had assumed would just be on board, like, for example, all Democrats will be supporting this. I think we're seeing that that's just not the case.
Thank you, Wanda, for your call. Reed is next from Clintonville. And our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Hi, Reed.
Good morning. I think your guest made a very cogent comment early on when he said that we're really a consumer-based society. And while things were functioning as far as people being able to afford all the toys that this society seems to really want, and no one really paid much attention to health care. And health care was somewhat more available because manufacturers or employers could provide at least a form of health care. But now that we have entered into this era, and healthcare is so highly overpriced, I think that within the next 10 years, we're going to see healthcare as a major aspect of our economic stability, and will it will perhaps, if we're not careful and don't do something about it right now, devastate our society. That said, I would just like to add that of all the guests that you have had on in recent times, Kathleen, I think that your current guest, this gentleman, and I'm sorry, I don't know his name. I tuned in a little
late. Daryl Paul.
Is perhaps the most partisan neutral, or one of the most partisan neutral of any of the guests you've had on recently. And I thank you for that.
Okay, thanks very much for the call, Professor Paul.
I think it must be because I'm a Minnesotan. I grew up there, went to college there, got all my degrees from Minnesota, so I'm a good, sensible Midwesterner.
Hey.
That's what it comes from. But in terms of the more substantive comment of your caller, we really are a consumer-based society. Over 70% of U.S. GDP comes from final consumption, and so trying to get that jump-started is, I think, what the Obama administration and the Congress are trying to do, rather than really try to transform some of the structural properties of our economy to get us away from depending so much on final consumption. And also in terms of the healthcare, I think your caller is quite right that the country is going to face only more problems in the future in terms of the cost of healthcare. According to, I think this is the Health and Human Services Department, healthcare spending is about 16% of U.S. GDP, which is far higher than any other comparable country, those countries in Western Europe, for example, we were talking about earlier. And it's projected by the I think it's 2019, to go up to a much higher level, something like 20% of U.S. GDP. The problem, unfortunately, is that this is a problem that's not demanding addressment right now. It's not a crisis. That's not to say that there's not lots of problems in it and lots of people aren't happy. Lots of people are unhappy with healthcare. But it unfortunately is something that we could probably stumble along and continue to go on this path for quite a while. I'm certainly not saying that that's a good idea. It's not a good idea at all. But unfortunately, I think that's probably the path of least resistance.
Hmm. Except it is a crisis for people who don't have insurance or lose their insurance, right?
But unfortunately, that is for the politics of solving or at least addressing these problems, that's a minority of the country. And so I think that's part of the politics here as well, is that you have an issue which is asking the majority who do have health insurance, who at least claim that they're relatively happy with it. And I've seen different kinds of polls that suggest that people who say they're happy with their health insurance are people who aren't sick and therefore don't really have much interaction with it. When they get sick and have a lot of interaction, then they get unhappy. But most people have health insurance. It's a minority. Now, it's a large minority,
right,
certainly. But in Democratic politics, it's no surprise that the majority who has health insurance is skeptical about big changes.
Who cares about the people who don't, as long as I've got mine, right?
maybe not quite that callous, but I think it is, well, yeah, we should do something about those people that don't have health insurance, but what exactly is that thing? And then we can't agree.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Jeff from Bruce. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a quick comment on our federal deficit on the way I see it, there is no feasible way to ever pay this debt off. But my understanding is when we signed into the foreign corporation of the Federal Reserve Bank, that at any time we could buy out of the Federal Reserve structure or the bank for a $600 million payoff, and we could just write off our debt and go ahead and print some new money. And maybe put some tariffs on to help protect some of our manufacturing, which keeps the nation alive. Without manufacturing and tariffs to make it just for both parties trading, there is no feasible way to have the United States to survive what it looks like we're heading for here. I live in Russ County. It's the highest unemployed in the state, I believe, and I think we already pushed through the percent mark on unemployment.
What mark? I didn't hear that. How much unemployment? Jeff, are you there? Oh. I don't know if you heard that or not. Well, you heard most of what he said, though.
I
Professor
did.
Paul.
Let me take the tariffs point first. For better or worse, I think that ship has sailed. The United States is a member of the World Trade Organization. The United States has made all kinds of commitments in international law to reduce tariffs, to not apply new tariffs to virtually every country in the world, because virtually every country is now a member of the WTO. And it's not just a question of, well, international law is a nice thing, let's respect it. It is that if the United States raises tariffs on other countries, then other countries can raise tariffs on the United States, and that's how the WTO works. So that would take a very serious overhaul of the whole global economy, I think, to return to a policy that really used tariffs as a matter of economic policy. In terms of the debt, the United States now has something like a 40% debt-to-GDP ratio. Sounds high, not terribly high in relative terms, but because of the tremendous deficit spending that the government's doing last year and this year, and certainly according to both the Obama administration and the Congressional Budget Office is going to be doing at least for the next 10 years, we're looking at heading towards 80, maybe even higher percent debt to GDP ratio. That's getting pretty high. So the question becomes, well, how much debt can the U.S. take on? Well, I don't think it's very profitable for us to think of the government and the government's debt in the way we might think of as personal debt, because sooner or later all of us are going to die and our debts are going to be resolved. But governments, at least not very many of them, die. And so there really is no prospect. I don't think anybody wants this to happen, that the government, the United States government, will someday pay off its debts. Governments tend to be in debt, or at least most governments tend to be in debt, for very long periods of time. Some of them always, forever. And so the question becomes, can we manage this debt? Can we fund it? Can we afford it in terms of paying the interest payments? Do we really want to spend whatever percentage of it is? I think it's somewhere in the 15 to 20% range. Do we want to spend that much of our annual budget on interest payments? Those, I think, are much better questions for us to think about and ask.
More phone calls in a moment. All things political for this Monday, the 24th of August. Our guest is Professor Daryl Paul, Associate Professor of Political Science at Williams College, and that's in Williamston, Massachusetts. As he said, he's from Minnesota and went to the University of Minnesota for his bachelor's and PhD, George Washington University for his master's. He teaches courses in world politics, the global political economy, imperialism, global political ecology, and the politics of the international economy. And we're talking about all things political this hour. More calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Monday, why do people seek out their opposites in spending attitudes? Most likely what we hate in ourselves, we also hate in other people. And the more we hate that quality in ourselves, the more we avoid it, according to a study that has been released from the University of Pennsylvania, University of Michigan, and Northwestern University. Connie Kilmark will be joining us to talk about this the second hour of our show. We have lines open for you for all things political. 800-486-8655 is the number. And we also have an email address you're ever so welcome to use, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. David from Oshkosh is our next caller. Hi, David.
Hi. So I'm a little appalled that President Obama, when he's spending so much time and energy on health care issues, has completely ignored the whole issue of litigation and lawsuits, which are by a wide margin the most expensive component of insurance, the most expensive component of any health care cost. They are the reason when you get into an emergency room, they give you 30 minutes with all kinds of paperwork to fill out before they'll even see you. They are the reason doctors want 42 different tests done so they can prove beyond the shadow of a doubt in a court of law, in case someone second guesses their initial diagnosis, that they should not be sued with no multi-billion dollar punitive damages. They are the driving force behind higher insurance rates. They are the driving force between higher costs of running a hospital. I talked to a doctor last week who delivers babies, who they give him $3,000 a baby, so he makes about $300,000 a year. He pays about $125,000 a year in income taxes. That leaves him with $175,000. And he pays $145,000 in malpractice insurance. So he's taking home $30,000 a year, and he's getting up at 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning to deliver babies. How long is an intelligent guy going to do that before he starts looking for another career? I think it is the biggest cost in health care insurance. It is the only reason that Europe and Canada and elsewhere can do health insurance cheaper, because they have tort reform. They have limits on punitive damages. In a frivolous lawsuit, if you're the plaintiff and you lose, you have to pay the defendant's attorneys in most places in Europe. And, that is the key problem. Solving that alone, we could cut 40% off of our health insurance, off of our medical care costs, and there's a multiplying effect through the system. It appalls me that Obama has not even broached the subject.
Professor Paul?
Certainly, I have not heard the president talk about this issue. This is one that Republicans usually bring up, Republicans are very concerned about. And I guess all I can really say, because this is sort of healthcare is not really my specialty, is that that there are lots of interests that are involved here. And certainly trial lawyers or those who have been injured are going to be much more concerned that they have the right to sue and the right to go to court. And this just seems to be an issue that the two parties cannot agree on. And since the Democrats are in power, they have the White House and the Congress, this is my best guess, I suppose, as to why we're not hearing about this issue.
Thanks very much for the call, David. And we should do a show on that issue, which we will. I find it hard to believe, though, that in obstetrician would only be making $30,000 a year. Doesn't that seem kind of low to you?
You never know exactly what the sources are. And certainly as I try at least to teach my students, it's very important to know your sources and go to reliable ones.
Right. Gary from Iron River. Hi.
Hi. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning.
I guess my thought is I think the people generally do want a health care resolution. I think people think it's a complicated issue. And it's one that most people really don't want a partisan answer. And what has worked in the past in the government is the commissions and things that have been done to resolve, say, Armed Forces base closing issues. And it seems like if we took a step backwards and started down that road and had a group of, you know, I don't know what exactly the makeup is, but a group of people who really understand and in theory would have the best interest of the people in the country at heart to come forward with a proposal, there's a chance for that to get sold and be accepted and something to happen.
Certainly the Obama administration has a role for, I guess for lack of a better term, panel of experts. Certainly not at the stage that we're at now, which I think the caller is talking about, that is formulating the policy itself, but having a panel of experts that will be able to make decisions about what kinds of procedures are included, what kinds of reimbursement costs or tables and schedules and whatnot will be used. Certainly it's a popular way, I think, for people to try to remove a lot of the politics out of contentious issues. What it tends to do, of course, though, is to give a lot of power to people who get to be considered experts. And so certainly being an academic, one might think that academics would love these kinds of things because we get to be experts on whatever issue it is and we get to be empowered. But I'm often concerned about panels of experts because they tend to remove a lot of democratic debate from the issue. And so if we're going to have lots of expertise involved, then regular people often don't get a say. And I think that's what we're seeing in terms of a lot of these town hall meetings that have been going on this month, that a lot of people feel that the government is quite far from them, that experts and insiders run everything, and that lots of common people don't get to say. They don't get to be heard. And so trying to appeal to a panel of experts, I think, would probably make even more people angry, or at least the kinds of people who are angry now would make them probably more vocal.
Thanks, Gary, for the call. Base closings, there's an issue we haven't heard about very much.
Well, certainly it was a way to, you know, kind of cut through the mess of the Congress because, you know, the Congress wanted to reduce the military expenditures, but by God, don't cut the base in my district.
Right.
And so, but I think this issue is a bit different from that because there are so many intricate dimensions of not just the healthcare system, but our whole economy that are at stake here.
Yeah. Catherine from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
I'm good. I just have a really short comment. I am really glad that everybody's calling in on the healthcare issue and talking about this. Just for a point of view on my end, I am a graduate from UWM, bachelor's and master's, and I'm in, unfortunately, an industry that is hit pretty hard by this right now. My degree is in architecture. There are a lot of quote-unquote displaced workers in my field, and I was laid off in January. I just got a new job in retail, which is amazing. I'm really excited, and I had the option for healthcare coming up after my probationary period. And just as a very general point of view, simplistic, I don't understand why, regardless of what party people are in, why people cannot step more than 3 feet from what affects their life. I mean, the idea of government, I assume, is the best for everyone. And I don't care if these people are in government, they're in D.C., or they're here in Milwaukee, or they're in Pound, Wisconsin, for God's sake, you know? I think that there's just a major issue with people not being able to look out for anyone besides themselves. I don't understand what a big issue is about giving an option for healthcare. I understand there are implications and complications with pieces and parts that are obviously unknown to me, but I just don't understand. I guess if anybody has insight on that or a comment, that would be awesome. That's it.
And Catherine, how long do you have to wait before you get insurance?
I have to pass my probationary, which I believe is 90 days.
Oh.
And I'm assuming, I've been told that the company I work for is amazing and they take care of their employees, but I'm really nervous because I have a lot of school loans that I got to pay back. I'm barely making it right now, and I don't think I'm going to be able to afford it.
Right.
I mean, that's it. Nothing too fancy.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call.
It's a completely legitimate, understandable concern. I think that when it comes to healthcare, people are a little bit maybe more reluctant to move, say, the 3 steps, as your caller described it, because it's not just people's wallets, but it's people's health and, I guess, ultimately their lives. And so it makes people perhaps more concerned. But I think that your caller has also tapped into something that I've really noticed in this debate, that the healthcare debate seems to be very disconnected to the rest of the political debates that are going on in the country now. So, for example, in healthcare, to get toward universality, lots of healthy people who may have very poor or very limited insurance, let me put it that way, or maybe have no insurance at all and say, I don't really want to buy insurance. I think I'm fine. I'm young. I'm healthy. And I'm not concerned. These people would be, well, maybe for lack of a better term, forced into buying some health insurance. But at the same time, one would hope that if there's a bigger vision of politics, the president, the congressional parties could say, and here's where your interest lies. This is why if you can sort of suffer in a small amount here, you can also gain someplace else. So maybe there will be, say, for example, taking the caller's experience directly, that there's something that the federal government can do in terms of student loans, say, because young, healthy people are going to be asked to be paying more for older, sicker people. Then why shouldn't older, sicker people also give something to younger people, maybe not in healthcare, but maybe in terms of education and loans and whatnot? And if we can put together a bigger vision of politics, some of these things might be able to get resolved, because not everybody can be made happy on one single issue. And that's, I think, what I've been a little surprised that the Obama administration hasn't done very much of. It's tried to tackle this one issue, really focus on it, and that that kind of hope and change and vision stuff that we all heard in 2008 seems to have been lost.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your call, Catherine. Stay good and healthy for the next 90 days, right? Well, that's it. Professor Paul, thank you so much for being with us this hour. I appreciate your time and insights.
Very happy to be here. I was in Wisconsin last week, in fact, visiting family. So it's good to sort of be back again virtually.
Good. Yeah, it is. Good to have you here. Professor Daryl Paul, Associate Professor of Political Science at Williams College. He's from Minnesota, originally educated in Minnesota and in Washington. And Williams is in Williamston, Massachusetts. He has expertise in world politics, global political economy, ecology as well, and the international economy and imperialism. We thank him for his time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this All Things Political Hour, and to Jalema Noel for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then another very interesting. Please stay tuned for this hour. You'll love our guest. She's no stranger to Wisconsin Public Radio on money and marriage. So that's coming up here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.